Session number 21627, Wheel 3.
Jack Pantelow, Reel 3.
Okay. Yeah, this black marketeer was coming into, was expected to come to this village, and I set the armoured cars out and kept in radio contact. But one of them was, because of the hills and woods, we couldn't keep contact with them. Anyhow, I was kept going between the cars, and I happened to be in one place, and this car came screaming down the road. I could see it coming down the hill, and it came around the corner and saw us sitting on the road, and he put his brakes on very quickly and was about to reverse out of the way, and we stopped him. Took this chap in, didn't question him too much. He was dressed in American uniform, and we took him into the police station. We weren't sure that this was the right chap, but he was very suspicious. And we were told to stay there and see if anything else developed, which we did. As I say, I took this chap in to the local police, and they apprehended him and put him in the cells. And we didn't get anybody else. Nobody else turned up. So later in the day, I went to the police station, and they said, he's gone. He'd asked to go to the toilet, and they just let him out, and he'd walked away. So whether he was ever found, I don't know. And nothing, as far as I know, developed on that side. And then we went to Brunswick.
That was in Holland, was it, or in Germany?
No, in Germany. And we were billeted in the Hermann Göring works. This might have been before Arnsberg, I think possibly it was, but anyhow. I went on leave before the regiment moved there and came back and eventually caught up with them and walked in on a Monday afternoon. I was then a corporal. Yeah, this was before Arnsberg, but never mind. And they said, you're in charge of the riot squad. I said, what the hell is the riot squad? And nobody seemed to be interested in telling me. And then suddenly the riot squad was called out before I could even get my kit off or get dump me kit and what have you. And off we go with a troop of blokes and a Dutch interpreter, and some Germans, or some DPs it turned out, were cutting down a telephone pole, and the German police had tried to stop them. Anyhow, when we got to where they were cutting this telephone post down, they'd gone, and the German police told us where to go. We went there, and it was a displaced persons camp full of shacks and of all sorts of construction. And when we got inside this camp, there was these blokes got this telephone post on a sawhorse, sawing it up, and they were making hooch with it. And nobody had told me what we were supposed to be doing on this riot squad. And went in this particular bungalow, and so we stopped these people sawing this pole up, and went into this bungalow, and one chappy in the troop says, look what I've found. He'd opened a stove, and inside the stove was the revolver. So we took that, and I went in another room, and there was a case on the floor, and I lifted the lid with my foot like that, and there was a dressing gown thing laying there, and sticking out from that was another revolver. So I picked this up. As I say, didn't know what we were doing, and you know, we decided we ought to take these occupants down to the control commission, which we did, handed them over. Next thing I knew, I was called out again at 3 o'clock in the morning to go back to this DP place, because the chappie that owned the suitcase where the revolver was, he wasn't there at the time, so he was still on the loose. And I was had to go back at 3 o'clock in the morning to try and catch him, but of course he'd obviously gone, he wouldn't hang about. And then shortly after that, I got called to go to a military court as a witness. And two of these boys that were arrested, only youngsters, they had been charged with assaulting and burglary and not rape, I don't think. Anyhow, it was a German firehouse. It turned out that they'd been to this German farmhouse and they'd fetched the people out and they'd made the women take the shoes off and they held the shoes up and shot through the soles and what have you. And these two lads were apprehended and put in prison, and I went to this military court where they were tried, and one of them had hung himself in the prison, and I found out that they'd both been in the concentration camp and they'd had fingers chopped off because they pinched a few cabbage leaves from the dump, and they were obviously getting their revenge. And the there's a whole lot of colonels and brigadiers on this court, and I wasn't called to give evidence. The lad admitted, and I remember the brigadier, whatever he was, saying, "By your own admission, you're accused of attempt murder and goodness knows what." And anyhow, he was put away for some time, and they brought him out to me, and or in the room that I was, and I spoke to him, and I had quite a bit of sympathy for him, and I gave him a cigarette, and some regimental police came round and blew his top and snatched this cigarette away from the lad, and that was the last I saw of him. But that was before Arnsberg.
Where did this displaced person come from?
I don't know, to be quite honest. I mean, there was these huge camps of displaced persons all round the steelworks. And, what nationality he was, I haven't got a clue.
And where was the DP camp?
Just outside Brunswick, by the Hermann Göring steelworks. Massive steelworks where they were all working, presumably, or had been working.
What conditions were they living in?
There were shacks. Shacks are built of anything, tin sheets or anything they could find. I mean, I think we came out of this bungalow, and I told a couple of chaps to guard these men outside while we searched the bungalow. When we came out, there was about 500 DPs there, and I thought, my God, if they set about us, we haven't got a snowball's chance in hell of getting out here. And, you know, I got these blokes on this lorry, a bit smartish, and we went off. But I mean, there was thousands of DPs around there. After Arnsberg, which was quite close to the Mona Dam and those sort of places. We'd been up there. There was a sergeant's club up there. I was made up to sergeant down in Arnsberg. And then eventually the regiment went into to suspended ammunition. And people were posted all over the place. And I was posted to the RAC training school up at Belsen. In the barracks just outside Belsen. Again, there was loads of DPs up there. And I think possibly that was one of the worst memories of the army. I went up there, and about a week later, another sergeant from the regiment was posted there. But he was an old soldier. He'd been in the 4th Tanks before the war, and so he was a time-serving man. He came up, and I took him down the sergeant's mess, showing where things were and what have you. And who should walk in but the RSM? And he looked at this other sergeant and he said, "Oh." And they knew each other. They were both in the 4th Tanks before the war. And they hung round each other's necks. And the RSM said to me, any friend of Sergeant Young's is a friend of mine. I thought, Jack, you're in trouble here. And within a couple of days, the RSM had got me on a charge for taking a vehicle. The road ran through this camp, and they'd got a one-way system in it, and no armoured vehicles were supposed to come on some of these roads. And I got detailed to go and fetch a can of camouflage paint in a dingo armoured car. And because of the system, I had to go round that way. And he stood round the corner and he stopped me and he put me on charge for being in that on that road. And I said, "Well, how? What other way is there?" And he said, "I don't want to know." And he put me on a charge. And anyhow, then he realised that there was nothing, no other option, and cancelled it. About a week later, I was in charge of the guard. And it was snowing a blizzard in the morning when orderly sergeant was supposed to dismiss the guard, and it was blowing a blizzard. And I said to these chaps in the guard room, "Well, there's no point in going out in this blizzard to form up and dismiss. I'll dismiss you here, and take all your kit out and what have you." Later that day, the provost sergeant came up and said I was wanted by the RSM. And I went down and he said, "You didn't dismiss the guard this morning." I said, "I did." He said, "You didn't." I said, "I did." He said, "You're on a charge for not dismissing the guard." I said, "Oh." And it turns out that somebody had left the rifle in the guard room. And it said they weren't dismissed. And then I found out that he'd put himself down as witness, this RSM, and he was living in married quarters outside the camp. So he wasn't there anyhow, so he couldn't be witness. And he then realised his mistake, and again, he said, "I'm not putting you on charge, I'll put you up in front of the adjutant for a warning." Unfortunately for me, I got out, I was demobbed within about 3 weeks after that, and back home. Which was the end of, not quite the end of my army experience, because I was called up on Z Reservist for a fortnight down at Linney Head in Pembroke, which was one of the old firing ranges that the yeomanry used to go to every year. But after that, that was the end of my military experiences.
How do you feel now about having served with the Northamptonshire Yeomanry in the Second World War?
I was very proud to serve with the North Ents. I suppose everybody found that their own regimental colleagues were the best in the country, but the comradeship was excellent. And there's quite a few. In fact, we still, hopefully next Wednesday, we've got a lunch with a few local NY people and their wives. And Lieutenant Jones is coming down, and there'll be about 13 or 14 of us there. Of course, there's always the reunion every October in Northampton, which I didn't go last year because I'd got a broken hip, but I never miss that if I can help it.
Did you have any after effects of having served?
Not really, no. You get... and your nightmarish effects on occasions, but it was a job that you had to put up with, and I felt myself very lucky to have got through it. Having got through it, it was an experience I wouldn't have missed, but again, it's easy to say that once you've survived.
What happened to you at Rosendahl?
Well, that that was close to the village of Lure, and in Holland, where we were going to spend Christmas. And I made friends with the local shopkeeper in Lure, and both my wife and myself went back. We were invited back to this family in Lure, and at that time we weren't living here. And there was two Lures situated between two towns, Breda and Roosendaal. And I thought, well, once we moved in here, I thought I'd name the house. It was, I forget what it was called before we moved in. And I thought, well, you can't call it Breda. We had no children. And so I called it Roosendaal. Some time ago, a chappie came here, and he said, I noticed your name, the name of your house is Roosendaal. So I said, yes. So he said, why and what for? So I told him it was what it was. So he said, that's what I thought, it was named after Roosendaal in Holland. And he was there with the tank regiment, and because I didn't know much about Roosendaal, I'd been to Roosendaal, but he'd got a little video thing that he showed me, and he'd perhaps be another individual. I can't think what his name is. He lives in a village the other way, Hargrave. But he was, he's most interesting. He had a lot of information.
How do you spell Lure?
L-E-U-R.
I've just interviewed Joe Eakins. Did you know him very much during the operation?
Yes. We were both in the same squadron. I was never in Joe's tank, never in his troop. But, we had a lot of connections, both being local.
What did you see of his action during the Battle of the 8th of August?
Nothing really, because, as I said, we were one troop were the lead troop, and were sent through this hedge, and Lieutenant Coakley was shot in the head, and we had to come back through the hedge and to get him out of the tank, and was were detailed by the second in command of the regiment to take up a position covering the rear of the regiment in case of trouble, and we were left there all day, probably forgotten about. So all we could do, all we knew, was that there was a battle going on the other side of St Agnan. We could hear the guns and that, but we didn't really know what was going on. And having been told to take up this position to guard the rear, we just stayed there. I mean, if we moved, we'd probably been in trouble. If we'd have gone forward into the village, we wouldn't have known what was going on or anything. So we just stayed put and found out what really happened the next day.
Have you any more memories of joining the regiment at Codford in West Suffolk?
Yes, we arrived late at night, and we were we were put up for the night somewhere, and in the morning each squadron was out on detachment and wasn't in the same, was in the same area as Codford, and we were at HQ, and we were called on parade in the morning, and the RSM Jelly took the parade, and there was about 50 of us, I suppose, on the particular draft to join the North Ants, and he was quite a big man and quite a loud voice, but his bark was much worse than his bite, and he sort of said, right, when I call your name out and do this, do that and what have you, and as often happens, you don't take a lot of notice. And I thought, well, beginning with P, Pentelo, I shan't be first. It's either start at one end of the alphabet or the other. And much to my surprise, the first name he called out was mine. And I didn't really know what I was supposed to do, apart from go farther up the drill square. And so I went running up the square and stopped and turned around. And he said, a bit farther, if you would, please. I thought, that's a nice way for an RSM to talk. So I went a bit farther and stopped, and it went on from there. And then I think it was at Berry's Nidman's was the first guard we had for, I don't know who came, was it a brigadier or the first inspection of the regiment anyhow, and he had a guard of honour, and RSM Jelly always used to pick me for because I was tall and that, I suppose, and hopefully quite smart, and I was always one of his special guards, because we had a King's inspection up there somewhere, and that was at Berry St Edmunds, the King's inspection, and I remember on one occasion at Berry St Edmunds we had a church parade, and I wanted to go out. I was detailed for church parade. I wanted to go out on the Saturday, but you had to have all your kit blancoed and cross belts and what have you. And we had a particular chappie named Sammy Green, who was a, putting it bluntly, a right bullshitter. And his kit were always immaculate, and he wanted a battery. And it's quite a long walk from Fornham Park in, outside Berry St Edmunds, and he wanted a battery for a torch or something. And he wasn't a particularly... He was all right, but he wasn't particularly light, because he was this bullshitter, if you like, and never give anything away. And I remember on one occasion that we all had parcels come. We were in these Nishnuts in these woods in Fornham Park, and he'd got a cake, and he'd got it under his bed somewhere, and he didn't say anything, but it disappeared. And he obviously thought somebody had pinched this cake. And yeah, we had a big inspection one day, and the timber plate of this Nissen hut had slipped off the concrete, and a rat had been in and dragged this parcel into this gap between the timber plate and the concrete, and he knew where his cake had gone. But what I was going to say, I said, well, if you lend me your belt and braces to go on the church parade, I'll bring you a battery back. So he said, okay. We made that deal, and I went on church parade. And you had to put these straps, I can't remember which way it was, either right over left or left over right. And I put these on because it was all joined up, and never thought to look. And the RSM inspected the church parade. And he said, what's one of my guardsmen doing with the straps over the wrong way? But, I always got on very well with him, but when I was made a sergeant and down at Arnsberg, and one of the things that you had to do was dismiss the guard in the morning at Rivalli, I'd put in an early call and I didn't get it. You also had to go up to his room before you dismissed the guard, so that he knew you were on parade, and he used to go swimming every morning down in Arnsberg, and because I'd missed him, and at 9 o'clock you had a report at RHQ and for the RSM's orders, and I got there, and I thought, I looked at my watch, and I thought, 9 o'clock, I'll tap on his door, and I stood there like this, and the door flew open, it was the RSM, and gave me the biggest rollicking I've ever had. He never swore, but he gave me the biggest rollicking I've ever had. And then he said, right, there's about 100 German prisoners outside, all come there into the camp to work. And he said, so many here, so many there, and I ain't got a pencil and a piece of paper. And he said, any that are left, take them to A Squadron to clean the cellars out. And I did know that A Squadron wanted were desperate to get these cellars cleared out. But by the time I'd allocated these prisoners of war, I'd got one prisoner left. So I took him to A Squadron and handed him over to whoever was in charge. And I thought, oh, I've got away with that. I'll have a lay on my bed for a little while and keep out the way. And then I thought, oh, I don't know, it's time I went and made a patrol and see if everything's all right. And marched up the barrack road and who should I meet but the RSM? And I thought, oh, he's the last person I wanted to see. And he said, just the man I'm looking for. He said, A Squadron creating because they haven't got enough men to do these, clean these cellars out. So I said, well, I allocated them out. And he said, well, don't worry. He said, go around, first 10 prisoners you see working, whatever they're doing, take them away and send them over to A Squadron. I said, okay. And he was a man, a very fair man. He never bore malice at all. And I had a lot of respect for RSM Jelly, and I was always never in trouble with him apart from that once. And as I say, he gave me a rollicking, and but that was the only time I got in. But there's, I mean, some people are different, made different, but I never saw the sense in objecting to these sort of things. It was easier to accept and do as you wanted and be awkward and get into trouble. But